Hey everyone, welcome to the Compass Podcast. Today, I am joined by a very special guest. This is a long time in the making. I have been begging and pleading this gentleman to join me for a conversation for quite some time now. So it's good that Ben Gagnon from Bitfarms is finally able to join us. But without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get to this episode with Ben.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you do, please consider subscribing and leaving a review on your preferred listening platform. It really helps out the show. The Compass Podcast is presented commercial free by Compass, the number one Bitcoin mining marketplace. If you want to get started mining Bitcoin, source hard to find ASICs, or find competitively priced hosting space, then check Compass out at compassmining.io. And now, on to the show.
Ben, what's up, buddy? How are you?
Hey, Whit. Not too much. Doing well. How are you?
Good, man. Congratulations on the big open this morning.
Yes. $1 billion company by US valuation. That's it's a big milestone for us.
Absolutely. Well, you guys have had quite the week with regards to news. Bitfarms is going to be listed on the NASDAQ. When do you guys start trading there?
We don't have final confirmation on the date yet, but it should be very soon. And we all expect it's coming, you know, in the next week or so.
Ooh, that's big news, man.
Yeah.
Now, are you guys the first publicly traded mining company to go from the TSX to NASDAQ?
Well, it depends on when we get that final date to confirm. There's a couple of us still in the running. My understanding is we should be the first one there, but there might be somebody who slips in right at the last minute. We'll see. But right now we're in the lead.
All right. There we go. Well,
the number one coveted spot.
Well, look, you guys, hey, mining's competitive. Anytime you can be number one, that's the way to go, you know? And I know that you guys have been, in my opinion, one of the most undervalued publicly traded mining companies for quite a while. And I think that, you know, in part that is because you guys have just been head down getting to work while, you know, arguably others may have spent more time in the press room, if you will. So Ben, I'd love to hear, like, yep, internally, as you guys are, I mean, growing tremendously, what's kind of your mindset? I mean, there is one side of the business that is, of course, you want to speak outwardly about what you have going on. And then there's the other side that dictates that you just operate. So how are you guys viewing this on a day in, day out basis at Bitfarms?
Well, I think we take it a little bit differently than most of our, you know, publicly traded peers. We really focus primarily on operations and the operational, you know, excellence, doing things right. So we built our first mine here in Quebec in 2017. We've built four more since. We've got three more under development this year and a couple more things in the pipeline rolling forward. So, you know, we're really focused on execution and operations and building out new infrastructure. And I think a lot of other people are more focused on, you know, trying to take advantage of the hot market or find a sweet deal right at the current moment. But, you know, for us, we've been here for a long time. We have a huge hash rate to start off the bull market at the beginning of this year. And, you know, we don't need to go out there and commit to something that, you know, we can't deliver on. Everything that we commit to is something that we have a very tangible and actionable plan, and we have clear, you know, milestones and progress to get there. So yeah, we're just focused on operations, and we're really glad to see that the market is starting to appreciate that and understand that. We are not the best at tweeting, or at least haven't been historically, but we are all starting to slowly understand the value of tweeting. So we're getting there.
And look, social media is an art, and it's hard to be a pithy smartass when you're also a publicly traded company, and you kind of have to be both, I guess, nowadays.
Yeah, that's a very, very fine line to walk. I haven't figured it out quite yet, but we're gonna slowly get there.
I guess you just have to transition the Telegram conversations to Twitter, and maybe that works. I don't know. I'm still learning myself.
Yeah, I mean, I stayed off. I think I got off social media about the same time I really got heavy into Bitcoin. And I think part of that was that, you know, back then, back in like 2014, Bitcoin was such a taboo subject. No one really wanted to talk about it. You were called crazy if you did talk about it. And I just found I didn't find the environment very supportive or conducive towards, you know, the things that I wanted to learn about and things I wanted to talk about. So I just got off there, and I found Bitcoiners on my own. And I come back years later, and I realize there's a whole ecosystem of Bitcoiners that, you know, have been very, very active in the meantime.
So 2014, you get into Bitcoin. We should get into that, man. So You've got a very interesting story. You're in Canada now, but you grew up and spent a lot of time in Asia. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm from all over the place. I was born and raised in Hong Kong, but I'm an American, and I've got a Quebecer surname. So I've got a, you know, little bits of here and there. And I've been following Bitcoin for a long time. I learned about Bitcoin in business school back in 2010. I had a chance to buy some Bitcoin from a friend of mine who was mining, you know, on his GPU machine. And my friend and I were going to buy in about $100, but it was used on this site called endoftheinter.net. And this is a cool thing that everybody was talking about. It was, you know, could this turn into something? Maybe, maybe not. But people were just using it to kind of swap files and that sort of thing. We didn't really see where this was going back then. So we went and bought beer instead. You know, we thought that was the better capital allocation. Instead of putting $100 into Bitcoin, sub a dollar, we're going to go buy $100 worth of beer. And went to the grocery store. We were going to buy Pabst Blue Ribbon because that was our, you know, beer of choice in college. And they didn't even have it. So we ended up buying Pabst Blue Ribbon Light. And I don't think anybody has a worse opportunity cost than I do. You know, $100 worth of Pabst Blue Ribbon Light or $100 worth of Bitcoin sub a dollar, that will really make you kick yourself for years to come. So as Bitcoin went up to $1,000 and then crashed back down to 400, I started to get back involved. I tried buying my first Butterfly Labs ASIC, never shipped it. Next year, I bought my first Bitcoins, held on to those for a while. Then the year after that, I quit my job and set up an Ethereum mining company in Taiwan. That quickly got too big. I moved it into mainland China. And then I had to leave there after about 2 years. That just got too big too quick as well. And I left for Alberta and I started this immersion cooled flare gas Bitcoin mining concept. And from there, I got picked up by Bitfarms at the end of 2019. So, you know, I've been around Bitcoin for a long time, lots of different areas, lots of different ways. I've missed out on a lot of fantastic opportunities. And now I'm here to share those experiences with people so they don't make the same mistakes that I have.
Oh, listen. If you were mining ETH in, what, 2016, 2017 in Taiwan, and then you transitioned, it got too big, you transitioned over to China, I'm sure you did okay.
We did okay. Yeah, we did okay.
Did all right, you know? So, especially if you held on to any of that. What is ETH, $4,000 a coin now?
Wish I would have held on to more, of course, but...
Crazy. But I mean, very few people have the experience of mining in Canada and in China. And I mean, obviously at the scale you're doing it now and you did it then, you've seen, you know, growing from a small to a large mine there and working as a part of one of the largest mining operations in North America now. In China, when you moved your facility over and started building there, how did you find the environment for miners?
You know, that was a really different time when I first moved into China in 2016, and people still were very unaware of what was going on in the industry. And so when I started meeting with landlords and real estate agents and everything else, looking for factory spaces and places with lots of power, people just couldn't even comprehend the amounts of power we were asking for in the small spaces that we were asking for it in. The power density was what really got them confused. They looked at me and they said, here's a white guy who's super young, obviously has no idea what he's asking for, and this will be fine. So I went to a lot of places that did not meet any of my boxes. And, you know, slowly got to the point where, you know, we were able to find a couple of unique opportunities for us to develop. But it was incredibly difficult, you know, operating a mine as a foreigner in China. Obviously, you're doing it completely in Mandarin, and none of it's done in English. Labor is tricky. Laws are tricky. It is a huge challenge.
So now when you say tricky, meaning, why don't you describe that? So tricky laws can mean a couple of different things.
It's a completely different system than we have here in the West. And by default in China, the guilt is assumed. And so you have to be really careful to make sure that you've done everything right and gone out of your way to find every sort of rule, every sort of regulation to comply with, you know, local, provincial, national, whatever that is. Because if you're in violation of one, they say, oh, well, you're in violation of this, and that's enough. There's no discovery period. There's no notice period. You're just guilty. And then the discovery period happens. And so you have to be very, very, very careful.
Or you disappear.
Or you disappear. And, you know, it's not something that I wanted to do long term. I wanted to keep Bitcoin mining, but I wanted to mine Bitcoin with, you know, out the complications and without the challenges I had in China. And mostly that was language and regulatory. And so for me, coming to the United States and coming to Canada makes perfect sense. You know, you got stable legal environments, you've got a bunch of people with a lot of capital, you've got all this old infrastructure, you've got incredible energy markets, some of them incredibly deregulated and free that it's easy to actually scale up into. It just made, it made perfect sense. And when you started running the math, actually, you know, a lot of the opportunities that we found in the US were cheaper than the ones that we could develop in China. And that's part of it is me being a foreigner and not having, you know, the full depth of access to the market that a local would. But part of it too is the US is incredibly competitive now in that space.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think just in general nowadays, it is more cost effective to mine in North America. And
I think so.
You know, I mean, power is abundant, especially now after COVID. And I mean, there's certainly no shortage of land. I mean, what do you foresee as any good reason for Chinese miners to not start looking more aggressively at expanding in the US?
Honestly, probably just a language barrier for some people. Beyond that, I really can't imagine why you wouldn't want to come out here. You know, in China, the facilities are done in a very, very quick and easy way. Right? Everything is done cheap and simple, and they can build out a megawatt, you know, for under 80 grand. But
wow,
there are complications, you know, with that, right? And the only way that those Chinese mines work is that they just have a lot of guys there that they don't pay very much. And they can sit there and they can respond to text messages and they can check on individual machines. These aren't things that you really want to babysit, though. You know, my biggest challenges that I had in China was with the downtime and everything else. This is such a valuable business. I don't want to have any downtime. And in China, you trade off your CapEx and your cost, you know, and associated with higher hardware failures, more downtime, that sort of thing. And what I found is that even with the migration pattern from Sichuan out to Xinjiang or Sichuan out to Inner Mongolia, you know, you average that out now. And that's basically what you get with a hosting company here in the United States all year round. Why would you really want to go through the hassles? Shipping everything back and forth, having the lower performance, having the lower quality facility, having the greater downtime, especially with mining profitability now, I think, you know, it's much more profitable to be up longer than to have slightly lower power costs.
I mean, how do you think that this is going to play out in the long term, right? Because Inner Mongolia has cracked down pretty hard on, you know, large power consumers. Are we getting to the point where that migration is going to have to cease? Are we, you know, how many more years is it going to be feasible for them to move back and forth? Do you think at some point they're just going to cut off that power supply to miners or to large power consumers in Inner Mongolia? Because it seems like they're trying to push them out as it is.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever going to happen, to be honest. I think there's going to be even greater reason as a customer for you to want to, you know, decentralize your hosting operations and spread them around and distribute your geopolitical risk that way. I think that makes a lot of sense, especially as a Chinese, you know, to get some stuff out of the country and just get it in a different location where you can have that cash flow and that revenue stream secure and stable. But I really don't see China shutting down the power anytime soon or really ever. I mean, if you look at the numbers at what China's doing in terms of power generation and power plant construction, it's staggering and it's drastically outpaces the rest of the world. You know, they're going to build 90 new coal powered plants this year. I mean, that's it's gigawatts and gigawatts of new production capacity. And that's this year. And next year, they're going to do similar things. And last year, they did similar things. And this is something that keeps happening year after year. And it seems like a very long-term competitive goal of China to, you know, develop their infrastructure and create an environment in China where everything is just so competitive and so low cost to manufacture. Why would you go anywhere else? So I think that's a hard trend to fight against economically. But geopolitically, I think that's the big driver for a lot of Chinese is get it out, put it into someplace stable where you do have legal protections and, you know, diversify that way.
Speaking of diversification, I mean, a lot of large mining companies tend to always look for areas in which they can expand, right? You stated at the beginning of the show that, you know, you guys are looking at expanding. Are we looking outside of Canada? Where are you guys kicking the tires and exploring new opportunities? I know you made the announcement about Argentina not too long ago, but what's going on behind the scenes with you guys?
Well, you know, we started as a North American company, but I think we do have global ambitions. And, you know, the first part of that is to try and take advantage of the existing infrastructure that's here in North America. But, you know, we see similar opportunities in Argentina that we see in Texas and Alberta. And we're going to see similar opportunities in other parts of the world as well. You know, we really look at this as an energy play. And the closer and the more vertically integrated we can get with the utilities and the distribution and the energy production, I think the more long-term and more competitive we are going to be in the long term. So for us, I think we need to be looking at new power developments and huge projects all over the world. And that's part of what we've been doing at Bitfarm since 2017 is focusing on trust, reputation, you know, operations and that sort of thing, so that when this time does come, when the power companies of the world, when the massive new power developments of the world, you know, start to look at Bitcoin and say, hey, you know, we have an anticipated 35-year ROI on this new power plant. But if we include a little bit of Bitcoin mining in it, we can cut that 35-year ROI down to 25 or 20, you know, and who are we going to do it with? And who does that make sense to do it with? And who's going to be a reliable, trustworthy counterparty and operator? You know, we want to be that company. And that's going to take us lots of places.
But where first?
Well, first, obviously, Argentina. we're developing Argentina. We also have multiple new developments here in Quebec. And we'll see. There are some other opportunities in the United States and Canada that we're also looking at. And, you know, they're in our portfolio of potential opportunities for us to develop. I think we're going to focus on the Americas, you know, for the next 2 years, probably through the next halving. But beyond that, I do think we're going to start getting a lot more global and have a lot greater international reach.
Have you guys looked at Paraguay and Brazil? I've had a couple of conversations with miners in that area. There's obviously a massive dam just there between Uruguay. Between Paraguay and Brazil, right on the border.
Yep.
Is that an area that you guys have explored?
Not at Bitfarms. I actually did some consulting on it with the previous company of mine. So there was a couple of different projects that were going in there. And, you know, those are the exact kind of projects that we would like to develop. Massive, large scale, tied in with the grid, provides a, you know, direct economic incentive that improves reliability and improves economics for everybody. It makes a lot of sense. And if I remember correctly, you know, that was a joint hydroelectric dam project that was built by Paraguay and Brazil, pretty much entirely funded by Brazil and pretty much entirely operated by Brazil. And Paraguay gets effectively, you know, a few gigawatts of power at zero cost. And so for them, they can either, you know, give it to their citizens, you know, at a subsidized rate, or they can try and, you know, create some industry and create some jobs and create some economic development in the region that will have, you know, the ripple effects going forward. And so it's hard to find companies who are going to want to make investments in remote regions like that. You know, what are you going to manufacture in a remote region like Paraguay that makes economic sense? And Bitcoin is one of those things that does make perfect sense. I mean, we have no storage cost effectively. We have no transportation cost effectively. You know, it's really, really easy way to, I mean, you can think about it as like a digital settlement, you know, for energy. It's the same way that the gas guys can use it as a digital pipeline for their gas. You know, you don't need to sell your gas through an actual gas pipeline. It's just the next evolution on that. You know, if you think about energy as a market, we've had constant evolution over time in terms of the generation, the distribution, and everything else. And it seems like Bitcoin is the next evolution in that, where, you know, now we actually have settlement. And we have if you have this piece of equipment, you're participating in the network, you know, you can get the full value of your electricity without transmitting it through the grid, without having all the inefficiencies, without having the transmission loss and everything else. And you can get the highest price for your energy of any market in the world.
So now when it comes to type of energy, I mean, you guys, Bitfarms, that is, you have, I mean, you've been at the forefront of this quote unquote ESG movement in so much as, I mean, you're 100% hydro, right? You guys are powered 100% by renewables. But how now do you guys view everything that's occurring with regards to the FUD around Bitcoin destroying the environment? Have you guys seen any negative blowback from this?
You know, that's a really interesting subject recently that it seems to be one of those things that gets really big every time Bitcoin's price goes up. You know, I think we get a little bit of a pass because we are 100% renewable. But, you know, the argument is pretty nonsensical. And I think it has a big component of people just not understanding how the energy grid works and how energy is created and distributed and transmitted to you. You know, there is a big misunderstanding even with our company that, you know, we're somehow taking power away from somebody else. And that's just not the case. You know, in order for anybody to mine, we're going to have cheap energy. In order to have cheap energy, the supply has to exceed demand. I mean, it's a basic economic principle, and it's something that has physical ramifications with electricity. If, you know, supply doesn't exceed demand, we will have blackouts. Like it's very clear when demand exceeds supply. We're never in a situation where we're taking power away from somebody. In almost every situation, we're monetizing the difference, you know, between supply and demand. And that's something that we've never even been able to address. It's something that's always plagued the energy industry, is the inefficiency of the distribution and transmission. It's the number one use of electricity worldwide is waste. You know, and this is where Bitcoin comes in, and we have the ability for the first time ever to monetize that electricity right now, settle it right now to a different marketplace, even if your local marketplace doesn't need it, you know, and that's transformative to the energy industry. I think people are starting to wrap their heads around it, and it's going to play a bigger and bigger part, you know, in all these projects. And I do think it's going to be directly incentivizing more energy creation projects, right? More power plants.
It's just the low-hanging fruit. You know, I know Harry Sudock has said this many times. Yeah, well, I mean, look, it's something that everyone can agree on, right? We want the environment to be cleaner. We don't want to damage the planet, right? And whenever someone comes out and says, you know, this damages the environment, it's very easy to say, well, then this is bad, because most people don't know how to measure environmental impact in reality, right? Like you see a picture of a dead animal or a beach whale or something with a title or a headline that's meant to catch your attention. And 99 times out of 100, you're not doing further research. You're taking it at face value, and it becomes this thing that you repeat to your friends over beer as you're discussing, you know, the good and the bad actors of the business culture in the world. And it's very easy to paint Bitcoin miners as the bad guys because, for one, they run data centers, which, you know, look like factories, act like factories. Factories have forever been terrible for the environment. And then two, they consume a shitload of power, like just a preposterous amount of power, but it's a feature and not a bug, right? It's not something where the average person can understand that, like, yes, do they consume as much power as a small nation? Sure. But every small nation consumes all of the power that they need to support fiat, right? Where Bitcoin consumes the power of one nation to support an entire financial system. So I think it's just perspective.
I think people don't really understand how, you know, centralized the energy production and consumption is. I mean, you look at US and China, and that's the vast majority of energy production and consumption in the world. And I mean, the two of them far outpace everybody else. I believe either one of them, you know, is more so than the rest of the world combined, right? It's such a large number. So to compare us with countries like way down the list, you know, it's a nice marketing tool, but it does not show the clear context of what's going on, right? Like if you run up the whole numbers, the total output for the industry is just under 0.1%, you know, of global emissions, you know, by that same number that Bitcoin consumes as much electricity as Argentina. And so they frame it as like, hey, Bitcoin is one of the largest energy consumptions, you know, source of energy consumption in the world. It's comparable to these huge countries, but they don't put it in terms of a global context. And I think that's very misleading. And the other part to mention there is, you know, hey, they're talking about Bitcoin is consuming as much energy as a country like Argentina. Well, you go to a country like Argentina, like we have, and what you'll find is that that country has built up massive amounts of more energy infrastructure that nobody is using. right? So here's a country that should be using a lot more energy infrastructure, but it's not. Why isn't it? They have it there. They've got all the resources. They've got all the turbines. They've got the distributions, the transmissions, the substation. Why aren't they using this? It's because there's no industry, right? They've created a situation right. where nobody wants to go in there and invest in new industry. No one wants to go in there and create, you know, new manufacturing. And so you can try and hold on to what's already there, but they're not facilitating any further investment. And so they planned all this growth with the electricity, and it just never happened. It never materialized. And so there is an opportunity there. And this is the same sort of opportunity that's going to exist in a lot of places all around the world.
You know, it's funny because it seems like nowadays obviously everyone understands that there's a shortage on the hardware, right? Hardware is hard to come by. But energy seems to be more abundant than I think most people realize. There is much energy that is available. And then you just have to come to the fact that, you know, there's certain geopolitically stable places that are going to try to fight for this. I think, you know, when I heard about Argentina and in our conversations with you, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, but I think South America is an incredibly stable place to do business. Yeah, maybe it's growing up in South Florida and having a lot of friends that were from that part of the world. But it seems like nowadays there are so many stable places politically that it's hard to make a case to keep everything in one location, right? I mean, any country could go wacky at any time. And if you're going to properly hedge, then you have to spread out your operations. There's risk everywhere, right? What do you guys view as the biggest risks in further North American expansion, if any?
You know, really, I think it's more of a jurisdictional and a legal risk right now. If you're developing certain kinds of energy sources over others in the United States, I think that is the only real risk. It's really hard to predict what's going to happen in this regulatory environment, and it doesn't seem like it's logical or predictable. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. Now, that being said, I think most natural gas resources are totally fine. And I think, you know, most other resources, hydroelectricity or grid powered, are probably fine. But we'll have to see on that. I think generally speaking, the U.S. is a great place to invest right now, especially until the next halving. I still see tremendous opportunities all over the U.S. in terms of built power plants, built infrastructure, built substations. The flare gas situation is one of the biggest opportunities for the United States and Canada that we've seen in decades. And, you know, funnily enough, that has the most measurable reduction in greenhouse gases. I mean, it's one of the few technologies out there that is not doing some wonky math to try and make sense of it. They're not matching. They're not, you know, offsetting. They're actually reducing. But strangely enough, you know, the most effective technology at reducing emissions is the least supported technology in the industry. And if you look at all the articles, you know, comparing Bitcoin to Argentina and everything else, nobody acknowledges that there is a direct economic incentive here with flare gas to profitably reduce your emissions without government subsidy. I mean, it's a very, very big thing for the United States. This is a situation that exists all over the country, and anybody can take part in it. You know, there's no restrictions on this. The scale is actually relatively simple. You know, we're not talking about building 100 megawatt facilities where there's a large learning curve. You know, for flare gas mitigation, we're talking about, you know, small gen sets, small amount of rigs, 10 to 15 rigs.
Yeah.
And you've mitigated that well. It's a wonderful opportunity. And I think we should learn a lot from the fact that nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, I mean, there's like the clearest visual examples of the benefits, right? Like if you look at a flare stack versus a Bitcoin mining facility, there a container that's dropped on one of these wells, it's a stark difference. I mean, you got a fire shooting into the sky with a black cloud of smoke or nothing, right? Just a gentle hum from a metal cabinet on an oil field.
Yeah. And I think the important thing is that these are here. Like these emissions are here. They're happening. They're measured.
Yeah.
And they're ongoing. And unless somebody does something, they will continue, right? And so, you know, most of the math out there is all about offsetting. They're one-time deals. They're all about matching. The math doesn't even make sense on the matching programs. But in this is permanent reductions. That's not only reducing the gas being emitted today, but every day rolling forward from that, you know, point. It really is a permanent solution, you know, to individual wells. And that's really, really transformative that people don't understand. If you look at the Google program for how they do their carbon matching. And what they do is that they just admit that there's no way that they can get off of hydrocarbon energy sources. So for every kilowatt hour of hydrocarbon energy that they consume, they're going to invest in new renewable production capacity somewhere else. And hey, that's all good, great. You know, more energy production, more power plants around the world. I'm all for that. But how on earth a number N0 averages out to zero is not clear to me, you know, in a mathematical sense. And this is a company, Google, that has made its money on binary computation, zero or one. You know, you're telling me that they don't understand this math. No, of course they understand this math, right? But nobody who's reading their programs and nobody who's writing about their programs can understand this math, and nobody really cares. What they want is to be able to put out a headline that makes people feel good. It's not actually about the reduction in the numbers or the reduction in the emissions. It's about making people feel good, you know, about what they did. So that's a hard, it's a hard thing to fight.
So that brings us to carbon credits, right? People just wanting to feel good. No, we'll skip that. I know there's some people that that are fans of the show that really do like carbon credits, and more power to them. I'm a free market guy. But when it comes to feel good headlines, the public mining company space, I mean, we got some serious players when it comes to these headline lovers. How are you feeling about the valuation of the competition in the PubCo space right now?
You know, we've seen huge valuation growth since about January of this year. I think when we were at the end of last year in November and December, and we were starting to see some price appreciation, Bitcoin was really outpacing the public codes. But as of January, I believe the pub codes have all outpaced Bitcoin. And the reason for that, I think, is really clear. It's an opportunity for institutional investors to quickly gain, you know, exposure to this industry, and they just don't have a whole lot of opportunities. I do think that the valuations right now are all over the place, and it would be hard for anybody to say otherwise looking at the public codes. You know, we really only have a couple of things to look at as a Bitcoin miner. How many Bitcoin do you have on your balance sheet? How many Bitcoin are you making every day? You know, how much Bitcoin equipment do you have coming in the near future? And if you look at all three of those factors, and that tells you 90% of what you need to know about a company. If you look at the valuations, they're all over the place. And mostly, it seems like the difference is a jurisdictional issue. So Canada has different valuations than the US. US has different valuations than Germany. And part of the problem is just the lack of those fiat on-off ramps, you know, and the interconnectivity between those markets. But I think eventually people will realize hash rate is hash rate, and there's no reason for there to be such a big disparity.
Well, I mean, okay, that was a very politically correct answer. And I appreciate you even speaking on that, because I know it can be tricky. It was nice of you to like give Germany a shout. I don't think they actually have mined any of their own Bitcoin. Traded company.
I mean, Northern Data, when they first listed on the Germany exchange, I mean, they had the highest valuation of any miner by far. I mean,
absolutely insane. High performance computing. I mean, a gigawatt of high performance computing by 5 months ago. Oh God, I love this sometimes.
The big problem, I think, with the PubCos is the difference between, you know, clear communication about where they are now and very misleading communication about what the future means. So, you know, we have no standard in this industry in order to try and, you know, context and quantify, you know, how big our mines are, how big our operations are, what that means for revenue, what our future equipment deliveries mean for revenue. And the market has clearly landed on a place where future deliveries drastically exceed the importance of currently installed equipment. And I think that's a newbie mistake. I think once people understand this industry more, they're going to put a much greater emphasis on installed equipment over future deliveries. But, you know, I think a lot of institutions are just now starting to learn about Bitcoin mining and the space. And, you know, it'll take them some time before they come to terms with all this new, you know, vocabulary, all these new models and everything else.
Well, and I think the danger of pricing future hash is that there's no guarantee that it comes online, right? We've had Marathon in their recent earnings. They're sitting on 3,500 new gens that they just haven't been able to rack yet. And you know, the delays happen, things occur. But if you price those in the minute that they're ordered, especially when these Bitmain orders, it's misleading as hell if you don't know what's actually going on. But, you know, you place a deposit on Bitmain machines. That doesn't mean you purchase all the machines outright. That just means that you have purchased the option to buy these machines at Correct. The market price that Bitmain gives the month that they're released. Which, look, hey, putting $30, $40, $50 million up as a deposit is no small feat. I see value in that. But having that future hash rate priced in, especially at the valuations that they're getting right now, it's just crazy. I mean, we're in an environment right now with the market that you can't really short anything anyway, but it provides some pretty clear short opportunities if you know what you're looking out for as time goes on with some of these companies.
Yeah, it's just a question about how quick the market is at learning, you know, this industry and all this information. And that's anybody's guess, I think, at this point, how quickly they're going to digest all of that. I certainly am not betting against any security in this environment. You know, I look at companies like Tesla, you know, whose PE ratio is over 1,000. You know, when I was in business school 10 years ago, you know, we were talking about PE ratios and PE ratios of 13 to 14 being normal and 20 being on the outside. You know, I bought my first shares when I was in eighth grade in Electronic Arts. So while people were buying video games, I was buying the shares of the company making the video games all my friends were buying, you know, and these were things we were learning back in eighth grade. Tesla has a PE over 1,000. It'll take 1,000 years before Tesla's earnings can justify their valuation. 1,000 years. 10 lifetimes. You know, I mean, it's hard to understand. but there's, you know, if you want to go short on 1,000 PE ratio, you're the crazy one. You know, I think that shows that this is not about the companies anymore, but the underlying environment with the US dollar and everything else. And you know, if you're looking at how US dollar inflation trickles into the market, I think securities is obviously one of the first places that it hits and one of the places that it hits the hardest. And so we look at Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation. We look at securities also as a hedge against inflation. You know, I mean, as long as it's not cash, it's going to be going up. We even saw that in Caracas. I mean, the Caracas stock market, I didn't check it, but I guarantee you it's at all-time highs today, just like it was at an all-time high yesterday. And it's been at an all-time high every single day for the past, you know, however many years, because the inflation is happening at such a rampant pace. Those securities are being, you know, revalued faster than other goods can. And so they're doing a better job at outpacing the inflation. I think we'll see that with securities. And I think we'll especially see that with Bitcoin securities. So we offer, you know, kind of a double whammy. Not only are we an equity, but we're also a Bitcoin, you know, equity. And so you're looking for that escape, you know, and you're looking for where the money is going to go in fastest and where the, you know, it's going to explode valuations the quickest. I think it's going to be in the public crypto space. And if you look at the market right now, I mean, it's hot for cryptos to go and get listed in the US. A lot of groups are trying to do that either through the front door, through a SPAC or something else. But people like these opportunities.
Yeah. Well, it is a very interesting time for the market. I think obviously with Bitcoin doing what it's doing, it provides a ton of opportunity for companies within the space to see unprecedented growth. And some are going to do the right thing. Some are going to do the cash grab thing. All we can do, or all I can do, is observe and have conversations with people I feel are doing the right thing. So yeah. Ben, I'm glad that you were able to come on the show so that we could talk a little bit about what you guys have going on. But before we leave, one thing that I always like asking people in this market, Bitcoin's almost at 60K. We're going to 200 fucking thousand US dollars. What are you most excited about right now?
What am I most excited about with Bitcoin going to $200,000? Yeah. Probably the fact that Bitcoin's going to $250,000.
Okay.
It's really nice to see after, you know, so many years in the industry and so many years of people saying, you know, what you're doing doesn't make any sense. Bitcoin doesn't provide any value. Bitcoin doesn't do anything. It's so nice to finally see everybody coming around. And, you know, I'm one of the first, you know, people that they ask. I was one of the first people that they dismissed, and now I'm one of the first people that they turn to. And that's always a nice thing to see is, you know, people willing to admit that they might have been wrong about something and wanting to learn something new. I mean, in today's environment, I think that's a remarkably fresh breath of air.
Validation, baby. It's all about that validation. Ben, let everyone know where they can find you before we sign off here.
Sure. You can find me at Hash Override. That's on Twitter or Telegram, Hash Override.
Look, man, you got the handle for social media. I think it's time for some shit posting. Get that follower count up, man.
Yeah, I got to work on that. I'm going to put out a couple articles here and there, and I'll have to start working on the memeing.
We're going to drop all of Ben's information in the show's notes, so make sure that you you check him out, give him a follow, and we'll also put the information for BitFarms on there so you can read up on them. But Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Whit.
That's a wrap for us at the Compass Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe and consider leaving us a 5-star review on your preferred listening platform. Thanks again, everyone. The thoughts and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on the Compass Podcast are their own and do not represent the opinions of Compass Mining Inc. None of this content should be considered financial advice.